Good morning. This is a Triangle Radio reading service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, March 21st, 2018. We start with the news section. Our first news story, Icebreaker. Durham County's friendly relationship with immigration authorities could change if Sheriff Mike Andrews loses his re-election bid. This year's race for Durham County Sheriff could be pivotal for how the agency interacts with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Clarence Burkhead, a former Duke University and Town of Hillsborough police chief, is vowing to do things differently than Sheriff Mike Andrews if he succeeds in the Democratic Party primary on May 8th, his second attempt to unseat Andrews. Over the past year, Andrews has frequently been criticized for unclear statements about his agency's relationship with ICE and for honoring so-called ICE holds, constitutionally problematic requests from ICE to hold people in local jails after they otherwise would have been released so that ICE can assume custody. A 38-year-old veteran of Durham law enforcement, Andrews was sworn in as a sheriff in 2012 after retiring Sheriff Worth Hill selected him to finish out his term. In response to community concerns, Andrews selected an officer to serve as a liaison to the Hispanic community and has staffed a Spanish-speaking officer at the county jail. Under Andrews, the agency also accepts Faith IDs, a non-government-ish form of identification. Andrews told ABC 11 he contacted state legislatures to oppose a 2017 bill that would have prohibited law enforcement agencies from accepting faith IDs. What's more, the DCSO has not, and will not participate in the federal 287G program, which deputizes local officers to carry out some immigration enforcement duties. Andrews wrote in response to a questionnaire from the People's Alliance, PAC, which endorsed him over Burkhead in 2014. Andrews wasn't available for an interview before press time. In public statements, the agency has variously said that it does and does not participate in another ICE program called Secure Communities, through which booking information makes its way from local jails to the Department of Homeland Security. In North Carolina, the information sharing aspect of this program is basically unavoidable. Fingerprints and other booking information are sent from jails to the State Bureau of Investigation, which is linked to the FBI's database. Federal law mandates that the FBI share that information with Homeland Security. Local jails, however, do have some latitude in whether to honor requests from ICE to continue to hold people who land in the agency's radar as a result. In January, then-DCASO spokeswoman Tamara Gibbs told the Indy that all detainer requests are honored at the Durham County Detention Facility. Asked for a copy of the policy by which jail staffers decide whether to honor a detainer request, Gibbs said that, at last check, the staff had no specific policy that addresses this question. Last year, 114 people were held at the Durham jail under ICE holds, including 57 who were released directly into ICE custody. Municipal courts have found that detaining amounts to a new arrest under the Fourth Amendment, and that the administrative warrants that typically come with them, which merely requires an immigration officer rather than a judge to attest that someone is deportable, are not sufficient proof that some probable cause exists to continue to hold a person who would have otherwise been released. Just last month, a federal judge in California ruled that Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department had violated thousands of inmates' constitutional rights by holding them on ICE detainers. Andrews didn't respond to an email from the Indy asking why all ICE detainees are honored and if he would keep that practice if reelected. Burkhead says that if elected, he would have a more open dialogue with the agency's critics and would allow members of the public to tour the jail in a controlled manner. Building trust with Durham's Hispanic and immigrant community would be a part of a larger effort to increase transparency and public engagement that also include the establishment of an office that is a liaison to all the people, particularly communities of color. I think the main difference I will bring is having conversation with those who want to protest, he said. Burkhead served as Duke's police chief from 1998 to 2005, when he became chief of police in Hillsborough. He left that post in 2010 to run for Orange County sheriff, but was unsuccessful. A few months later, it was made public that the Hillsborough department was being investigated for improper record keeping at the direction of an accreditation manager during Burkhead's tenure. He was associate vice president of safety and security at Queen's University until 2012 and has worked as a security consultant since. In the 2014 primary, Burkhead won about 39% of the vote to Anderson's 56%. If he became sheriff, Burkhead says he will only honor detainee requests that come with a judicial warrant or an outstanding warrant for arrest. If the federal government wants to criticize us for not honoring detainers, I'm okay with that, because I think the community at large will be appreciative of that approach and appreciate us for being good stewards of local resources, Burkhead said. There's nothing in the federal law that says I must participate. The change would bring Durham County's policies more in line with Orange County's, which, since Sheriff Carl Blackwood took office in 2014, has not honored detainer requests unless continued custody is supported by probable cause to believe that a criminal violation of federal immigration law has occurred, for example, by a judicial or outstanding warrant. Enforcement of federal law should be accomplished by federal actors and not by local law enforcement, Blackwood said. I am committed to being responsive to the needs of all members of our community, regardless of a person's immigration status. Blackwood is also up for re-election this year and faces a Democratic challenger in Tony White, a former investigator with the Orange County Sheriff's Office, whose platform emphasizes reforms within the agency. Blackwood began his law enforcement career with the OCSO in 1980 and retired as a major operations in 2012 to run for sheriff. In a statement, he identified emergency services infrastructure, opioid use, racial disparities in the criminal justice system, and school safety as challenges he'd like to address. White worked for the Orange County Schools Transportation Department for 9 years before joining the OCSO in 1997, serving in the Resources Office and Patrol Divisions before joining Criminal Investigations. He retired in 2016 for personal reasons, on which he declined to elaborate. White told the Indy that he would cut spending, engage more with local youth work to prevent drug overdoses, and have more of a diverse department. If elected, I would ensure that everyone, regardless of who they are, where they live, what color or race or religion, that they get treated the same, he said. On immigration enforcement, White says he isn't fully familiar with the OCSO's current policies, but he is totally against the ICE program. He says he would have to look into his obligation to honor detainers with administrative warrants, but he would only honor requests accompanied by a valid warrant with which the sheriff's office is obligated to comply. The primary is May 8th. There are no challenges from the outside the Democratic Party in either the Orange County or the Durham County Sheriff's race. The next news article, an accidental contender. When Allison Dahl challenged Dwayne Hall, she didn't expect to win. Then everything changed. "We're getting into a sticky wicket," says Allison Dahl, a Democratic candidate for the General Assembly. "I do not want to run on my opponent's failings that have been publicized. As a woman, I'm troubled that this is going on, and I think we need to be very careful in how we communicate with people and listen to what they're saying." She pauses. How's that for sidestepping? Dahl signed up to run against State Representative Dwayne Hall before she knew she might have a chance. Hall was, until a few weeks ago, a rising party star. Everyone assumed he was running for lieutenant governor in 2020, and who knows what after that. He had money in the bank, loads of name recognition, a pragmatic record, and a winning smile. In his Democratic-leaning District 11, he was all but invincible. So, when Dahl filed to run in May 8th primary, she didn't expect to win. After President Trump's election, she began working to organize Democrats in some Wake County precincts, but she's hardly a player on the party stage. Still, she said, she wanted to get her perspective out there, that of a woman, a lesbian, in a political system dominated by white male lawyers, and perhaps set herself up for another campaign down the road. And then everything changed. On February 28th, the last day of filing, the progressive website NC Policy Watch published a story detailing accusations of sexual misconduct against Hall. Hall emphatically denied the allegations, but Governor Cooper, State Party Chairman Wayne Goodwin, House Minority Leader Darren Jackson, and other top Democrats called for him to step down. Hall remained defiant, accusing Policy Watch of having a vendetta against him and going so far as to allege that Policy Watch had violated its nonprofit status by interfering in an election. Since then, Hall's path hasn't gotten any less rocky. The Young Democrats of North Carolina turned on him, pressuring his campaign donors to donate to NC Women United and maintaining a public list of the politicians who have, and have not, called for his resignation. And last week, the third person in District 11 primary, Heather Metor, dropped out, citing family issues. That leaves Dahl as Hall's sole challenger. He'll have to win with an outright majority, despite the opprobrium he faces. And that means Dahl has a chance if she can rally progressive outraged at Hall's alleged behavior. "It's generational," says a Democratic operative who asked not to be named. "The younger operatives, they're not having it. And they're the ones Hall was friends with. It may not be a slam dunk for Dwayne." In an interview Tuesday, Hall told the Indy he's kept quiet in recent weeks because he's in a no-win situation. "My immediate response to the allegations was to try and talk about everything," Hall said, "but any response I gave upset people more." He insists that the Policy Watch reports misrepresented what actually happened. In one case, in which he was accused of forcibly kitching an unnamed Democratic Party official at a party function, Hall said he and the woman, who he says declined to talk to the media, had been friends for 20 years, and she went to kiss him on the cheek, like a sister. He thought it would be funny to turn his head and catch her on the lips. It wasn't, he admits. But he says he meant no harm. The media took that incident and portrayed it in a very different light, Hall said. He points out that he and the woman are still friends, and she recently went to lunch with him and his fiancée. There was a separate reported incident in which Hall was accused of forcibly kissing a woman at an Equality North Carolina gala. That woman, who remains unnamed, did talk to Policy Watch and confirmed that story. Asked about the party officials who have demanded his resignation, Hall says, "I was upset that friends would do that quickly. I feel like they acted with the best intentions, but without the facts, without having heard my side." As much as his race will turn on whether the voters in District 11 believe the allegations against Hall, and as much as Hall's alleged foibles have given Dahl an opening, the challenger said she doesn't want the allegations to define her campaign. Dahl is a Raleigh native, born in Rex Hospital. She earned a bachelor's degree in theater and speech at the University of South Carolina, then worked as a stage manager before transitioning to a career helping people with disabilities find jobs. She moved back to Raleigh about 13 years ago to be closer to her mother and worked as an office manager for a law firm. That's not quite the stuff that political careers are built on, but Dahl thinks her background could prove advantageous in the legislature. She wants better funding for schools and health care, and for the state to finally expand Medicaid, all boilerplate Democratic positions. She also argues that, operating in the minority, she'll be able to effectively work across the aisle. "I think compromise is not a dirty word," Dahl says. "I think being a novice in the political system will help me. I don't have any bad blood out there." Our next article, First Responders. As the state slashes mental health funding, a local pilot program seeks to keep people with mental health issues out of the ER. In the fall of 2017, Danny, a 29-year-old from Durham, stopped by the office of Carolina Behavioral Health Urgent Care in the middle of an acute mental health crisis. Danny, whose real name the Indy is not sharing for medical privacy reasons, was homeless and suffering from a major depressive disorder with psychotic features. When Danny arrived at the Behavioral Health Urgent Care, or BHUC, he was paranoid, so much so that he was not able to ride the bus or stay in a local shelter. Instead, he was living in the woods. For Danny to manage his condition, he needed to be looped into mental health services as soon as possible, medication, therapy, and outpatient care. Danny's success with long-term treatment had not been great. Over the years, he'd bounced around various mental health agencies, but likely due in part to a combination of his homelessness and his mental health condition, he was never able to consistently stick with a care regimen. This time, though, was different. Danny felt his symptoms worsening and getting in the way of his ability to function. He believed he needed to be back on his meds, but he didn't have insurance. When Danny walked through the doors of BHUC, he had no idea that the program supporting him was new, set up to help people just like him. It's the only service of its kind in North Carolina, in fact, located in an unassuming building off Durham Chapel Hill Boulevard. The year-long pilot program, which launched in July, was created to fill a gap in the local mental health care system. It's best thought of as the psychiatric version of an urgent care clinic, a destination for patients who may need their medications refilled or want to be seen by a clinician for anxiety or depression, but don't necessarily need to go to the hospital or a higher-level crisis facility. In the past, a patient like Danny may have ended up in the hospital's emergency department, a designation that is becoming increasingly common for patients in need of mental health care in North Carolina. Compared with other states, North Carolina sees nearly twice the rate of patients with any psychiatric needs who opt for the emergency room each year, according to the Charlotte Observer. The system is costly for hospitals, which have to absorb much of the cost for people who are uninsured or covered by Medicare, and ineffective for patients who can end up waiting for hours before being seen, or days before being admitted to a state-run psychiatric hospital. Those problems will likely be exacerbated as mental health funding declines in North Carolina. This year's budget made cuts. Publicly funded mental health organizations, also known as local management entities or managed care organizations like LME MCOs, which cover the cost for mental health services for people on Medicaid or without insurance. In North Carolina, there are 7 LME MCOs: Alliance Behavioral Health Care, which serves Cumberland, Durham, Johnson, and Wake counties, was hit with a $19 million cut for fiscal year 2019. Alliance received about $495 million last year, much of which came from Medicaid. The total funding for the 7 LME MCOs was reduced by $90 million. Unfortunately, North Carolina has been cutting mental health care services through the money of the LME MCO systems consistently these past few years, says Nicole Karim, the interim executive director for the National Alliance on Mental Health Issues in North Carolina. 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness in a given year. That's about 20% of North Carolina who are dealing with a mental health diagnosis. When mental health care is not funded adequately, or there's not an array of services available to folks, then we see the people lose their jobs, or people end up in the emergency room because they don't have access to the care they need. Or people may end up in jail or prison, experience homelessness, or die by suicide. With services already strained, BHUC is trying to ease the burden on local emergency rooms. Although the ER is often the first and only stop for patients seeking psychiatric care, it's not always the best choice, BHUC clinician director Marissa Holstein explains. A lot of time is just not appropriate, she said. Everyone goes for a lot of different reasons. They estimated the wait to be about 6 hours. Anecdotally, it's never that quick. A lot of times people can spend the whole night in the emergency department waiting, and then in the morning someone is like, "Hey, you better be better served by behavioral health care, urgent care. We're hoping that we would fill this gap in the crisis continuum." The process for the patient like Danny walking through the BHUC's doors for the first time is relatively quick. Clinicians see clients ages 4 and up who live in Alliance's coverage area and who either have Medicaid or are uninsured and are eligible for state mental health funds because they meet or fall below an income threshold. That's $71,550 for a family of 4. Services for eligible patients are free. The BHUC provides safety assessments, crisis counseling, medication, and connections to further mental health care. Patients come in for a range of reasons, Holstein said. We see people who are like, "I'm in crisis. I might feel suicidal, and I need support. Crisis counseling and appropriate referrals because I'm going to need more than what you can provide here," she says. And we also see people who are like, "I'm about to run out of my medication, and I can't see my psychiatrist for a week, and I'm not in crisis yet. But if I stop taking my medication, there's a high likelihood I will go into crisis." When Danny stopped by BHUC, he fell into the category of patients who needed help with medication. He did not have Medicaid, but the program was able to connect him with state funding for services while he waited to get his Medicaid activated. Now he has a therapist, a caseworker, and a community support team that will bring him to BHUC for his medication appointments, an injection once a month. His community support team, meanwhile, sees him about once or twice a week. During a particularly cold snap, BHUC got the paramedics to deliver him a sleeping bag and a toiletry kit. It's possible those services helped help prevent Danny, who has previously been in and out of jail, from cycling back into the criminal justice pipeline. Since his first visit with BHUC in the fall, he has become a regular client, and he's currently waiting on Medicaid approval. Occasionally, he'll just pop into BHUC and say hello. One of the reasons this model may be successful for patients like Danny is because it brings providers directly to them, an approach common in urgent care centers. The way the model is set up, the urgent care model, where an individual comes into a clinic, stays in the room, and then the providers come to that individual, that's pretty unique in the behavioral health community, says Margaret Brunson, Alliance's Director of Hospital Relations. On a Thursday afternoon at BHUC, a receptionist calmly answers patients' questions while a handful of people wait to be seen. Holstein files past patients in the waiting room and gives a brief tour of the space. There are 8 clinic rooms in total, including a play area for patients' kids, decked out with books and toys. The rooms are painted white, decorated with potted plants and colorful paintings of trees. The goal is to make the patients comfortable, Holstein said. We want to bring our services to them. The program came about after Alliance reached out to a group of therapists and social workers at the mental health organization Carolina Outreach and asked if they'd be interested in teaming up on a pilot project. Carolina Outreach concurred. The program is funded by Alliance, which covers the costs of uninsured patients who aren't on Medicaid. Patients are often referred from their primary care providers, hospitals, mental health courts, and schools. BHUC is also working with crisis intervention officers at the Durham Police Department to help set up a guide their officers about when it would be appropriate to send patients to the clinic instead of an emergency department or crisis facility. So far, gathering clients has been a bit of a slow burn. The question for service providers and other state-funded care organizations that cover counties outside of Alliance purview is whether the program is working well enough to continue or be replicated elsewhere. It's as yet unclear if BHUC has achieved its goal of reducing emergency department admissions. Alliance is still in the process of figuring that out, Brunson says. We know anecdotally that people are choosing this facility over the emergency department at times, she said, but we don't have any clear data at this point, not yet, to see how much we're diverting people from the ED and if we're impacting ED admissions. And I think that's something that will probably come out in time as well. Holstein says that the program's numbers aren't where she wants them to be. The clinic typically sees about 6 to 9 clients a day, though it has the staffing to serve 12. On slow days when the weather is bad, it can see as few as 2 or 3 clients. Even without the clinic operating at full capacity, Brunson says, keeping BHUC's doors open after the pilot program expires at the end of June is a priority. Alliance plans on supporting the program for the 2019 fiscal year, although it does not know exactly how much money it will be able to set aside for patients without insurance. After the year is up, it will reevaluate its support for the program on an annual basis. Wake County wants to bring a similar program to its residents. Commissioners plan to set aside $750,000 in this year's budget to create their own vision of BHUC. We have seen what our neighbor is doing and observed how effective it has been, and we want to try to improve our outcomes in Wake County, said Commissioner Matt Calabria. This is a tremendously exciting program because there is a huge unmet need in the community, and this is an opportunity to be very proactive about it. He continues, "A lot of this stems from the state not doing its job. We are constantly battling a state that underfunds behavioral health care. So far, BHUC's clients seem satisfied with the care they've gotten. Since launching in July, BHUC have served about 700 patients, 98% of them, according to a survey the clinic conducted, said they were extremely satisfied with the program services. About half said they would or may have gone to the emergency room if they hadn't gone to BHUC. 95% said their needs were met after their visit, a success rate Holston chalks up to the strength of the clinicians and how they engage the client. Clients hail from beyond Durham, too. As the word slowly trickles out, BHUC is seeing patients from across the four counties that the Alliance serves, some even driving more than an hour for a visit. But the long haul is worth it, especially for clients who need BHUC's help with medications. Sometimes a patient may run out of medication before his or her next appointment with a doctor, and BHUC will provide medication bridges, enough to get the patient through a potential crisis before the next appointment with a provider, which, in a strained mental health system, happens more than you might expect. We have people who go in and out, are seen by a psychiatrist somewhere else, get started on a med, go to fill it, and can't afford it, says Holstein. But for some reason, and I think it's the volume, they cannot get back in and get that addressed or changed in a timely manner. So they come to us and say, I'm trying to get this medication filled, but I can't afford it. So we can offer different options. A lot of times, thankfully, there are different types of medication that have a similar effect that could be cheaper, and sometimes it's just linking them to the right pharmacy and helping them do some of that legwork and then just calling around. And now a look at the Back Talk section. We begin this week with Ryan Cummings, a local leader with the Sandy Hook Promise, a nonprofit that seeks to protect children from gun violence, who writes, "We have had far too many moments of silence since Sandy Hook. Our children and community deserve real action to stop the epidemic of gun violence. We're not alone, and we're not helpless. There are many seemingly simple yet powerful things we can do today. More and more of our neighbors are united to bring the change we need. The phones in Congress are ringing off the hook with calls for commensurate gun reform. Peaceable rallies are growing in numbers in cities across the country, and families and friends are gathering together in their own living rooms to talk about bringing violence prevention programs to their schools. There is reason to have hope that we can prevent gun violence before it happens through sensible gun safety laws and programs in our schools and communities that help us identify the signs before a shooting happens and then intervene. To keep this hope alive and bring the change we need, I'm asking anyone and everyone to take two simple actions today. First, call your member of Congress today and ask that he or she support gun violence prevention legislation to keep guns out of dangerous hands. Secondly, make the promise at SandyHookPromise.org and help bring Sandy Hook Promise no-cost violence prevention programs to our schools and our community. Next, Joe Swain Jr. responds to comments in last week's Back Talk about the Durham Confederate Monument, which make me wonder if there are people uncomfortable with either side. I'm not a Confederate sympathizer. I'm glad we lost the Civil War, but note that it is we who lost. But am I unique, or do people like me just not speak out? Some of the points made in Backtalk are valid. Timothy Simpson is right when he notes that some communities were devastated by the loss of almost all their young men. Honoring those who make this sacrifice is what people do. Greg Pearson is right when he points out the timing of memorials is often several decades after the fact. Indeed, northern towns were commissioning statues at the same time. He is also right that the KKK of the 20th century was a national movement. And Gordon One is right that the money for the memorials was raised from the people of a community. But while I agree with these points, I can't endorse calling people who oppose Confederate memorials trash, thugs, and cowards. I don't think that slavery and Jim Crow are the totality of the heritage of the South, but they are an undeniable part of our heritage, and the protesters are right to call that to our attention. As for the memorials from the Civil War and its aftermath, I don't want to destroy them, but I don't want to leave them just as they are. They reflect a context of the racial divide that stains our history, and it is appropriate to amend them with the sentiments of our changing values. I personally would love to see every Confederate monument augmented by a quote from General Grant. Acknowledging brave men who fought so long and valiantly and had suffered so much for a cause, though that cause was, I believe, one of the worst for which a people ever fought. And now from the indie food section, Mystery Meat. The Impossible Burger is a veggie burger that almost bleeds. How do you want that cooked? This is a normal question to hear when you're ordering a cheeseburger, but I haven't eaten a real cheeseburger in 4 years. What I'd ordered was a veggie burger, and those are usually just a matter of heating until warm. It's not like you have to worry about E. coli if your black bean patty comes out too pink. Huh? I asked. How do you want that cooked? The lady at the counter reiterated. I was at the all-day cafe on the ground floor of the Unscripted Hotel in Durham, ordering the newest vegan addition to the menu, the Impossible Burger. Supposedly, the closest thing to animal flesh you can find without having to kill a cow. Medium rare, I guess. The standard order at the all-day comes with a vegan cheese and mayo, which I subbed out for Gruyere and real mayo, as well as avocado, spinach, and tomato. $10. Down the street at Bull City Burger and Brewing, which had sold out on my visit on a recent Sunday, or in Raleigh at Fiction Restaurant and Remedy Diner, you can find the Impossible Burger prepared similarly, though with some accompaniments swapped out. At Remedy, you get veganese and mustard, no avocado. At Fiction, it's gizmo stout, braised onions, malt vinegar slaw, pickles, Green Man IPA mustard, and homemade vegan cheddar. But wherever you get it, the main draw is a vegan patty that tastes and looks and feels decidedly non-vegan. The burger bleeds juices when you bite the meat, looks indistinguishable from the real thing. It's not geared toward actual vegan customers, says Hank Luther, the general manager Unscripted. It's too close to meat for many vegans' comfort. Its real value lies in giving carnivores a plant-based alternative and getting them to think about the impact of the meat that we eat. Bringing the Impossible Burger to Unscripted was his idea. Luther primarily eats a plant-based diet, and before taking over Unscripted, he lived in New York City, where he watched the Impossible Burger go from a handful of restaurants to hundreds of restaurants within a year. An explosion, as he describes it. He wanted to be the first in the triangle to get it, but he had to settle for being one of the first. The Impossible Burger, according to Impossible Foods, its manufacturer, is the result of 5 years of research into what makes meat taste like meat and figuring out a way to replicate it with plants. The patty uses standard veggie burger ingredients such as wheat, potatoes, and coconut oil. Impossible Foods website says, but the secret is heme, an iron-containing compound that is uniquely abundant in meat and makes meat smell, sizzle, bleed, and taste gloriously meaty. Heme is also found in plants, which means it makes it possible to create a food that has all the characteristics of meat but has no animal products and generates considerably less wear and tear on the environment. This according to its maker, at least. Does it, though? For the most part, yeah. The burger is delicious. Quite a bit like I remember actual hamburgers tasting, and quite a bit closer to that goal than ever the best veggie burger around. In an attended article, the Bull City Vegan Challenge returns. The fifth iteration of the Bull City Vegan Challenge kicks off next month with chefs at 10 meat-centric restaurants in and around downtown Durham competing to see who can create the most popular plant-based specialty dish, as judged by diners' votes. This year's participants are Dos Perros, Panizzati, Pompieri, M. Coco, Juju, Gugelhumpf, Counting House, Jack Tar Diner, Unscripted, and Grub. At M. Coco, known for its Korean fried chicken, you can order biang biang noodles with soy braised shiitake and ground tofu. Pompieri, a pizza restaurant, will offer a pie with a base of eggplant, house-made vegan mayo, and house-made vegan mariscope. Mariscope will be roasted with shaved fennel and mushroom. Dos Perros will feature chili relleno, a roasted poblano pepper, and Brussels sprouts and sweet potatoes with esquites tradicionales, fresh corn off a cob, lime, vegan mayo, and poblano and chili peppers. The idea was Leon Seyart, who organizes the challenge. It was not only to showcase Durham eateries and proselytize the plant-based lifestyle, but also to show how people in demand and could popularize vegan options and encourage restaurants to keep vegan items on their menus year-round. The competition has three categories: best overall entree, best appetizer, and best use of theme, which this year is sustainability. Things like sourcing local, organic, seasonal produce and not using plastic straws. The chef who wins best entree will receive a two-night staycation at the Unscripted Hotel. Other local companies donated prizes, including Green to Go, Global Breath Studio, Seven Star Cycles, Bulls of Durham, CrossFit Durham, Bull City Records, and the Pinhook. The challenges begin April 1st. Arcana will host a kickoff cocktail party featuring, naturally, a vegan cocktail on April the 4th. We turn now to the music section. Sea Change. Durham Performance's inaugural Black Atlantic Festival puts Caribbean, African, and South American cultures in conversation. In the 17th century, a ship of enslaved people from modern-day Nigeria were shipwrecked on the Caribbean island of St. Vincent. Knowing they were fated to work on plantations or mines if they were discovered, they hid among the Arawak, indigenes of the region. The communities began to intertwine. Legend has it that the Arawak taught the West Africans how to fish, and the West Africans taught the Arawak how to dance. Over the next 400 years, though through multiple encounters with colonial powers, some peaceful, some violent, this new group of people moved across the coast of Central America, always evading the threat of slavery. Through these migrations, they developed a language melding Arawakan, Spanish, French, English, and broader Caribbean influences. Now this language and culture, called Garifuna, can be found in Honduras, Belize, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. The history of the Garifuna people is just one of the stories of the intercontinental transactions of people and cultures across the Atlantic Ocean. Duke Performances celebrates that history with a festival that begins Monday. Over the course of the week-long festival, six artists representing Mali, Venezuela, Honduras, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic will perform in Durham. We know that there is a cultural passage that exists that opened up very tragically, says Duke Performance's executive director, Aaron Greenwald, referring to the transatlantic slave trade that trafficked an estimated 15 million enslaved Africans to Europe and the Americas. But then we know that there is a constant generation of musical exchange across these communities, and it doesn't move in one direction. It's dynamic. There's a back and forth. Over the years, Duke Performances has incurred a track record of hosting international performances from Africa, the Caribbean, and South America. But the festival is an occasion to bring these different performances and their musical communities into a common conversation. Greenwald consulted Laurent Dubois, a scholar of the Atlantic world, and Jonathan Henderson, a musician and PhD student in ethnomusicology, among other enthusiasts and experts, to create a festival he plans to make an annual event. In fact, while I was visiting his office, he received an email confirmation from an artist for next year's festival, and he pumped his fist. One theme that I think music of the Black Atlantic has is that its performance serves as much as a social function as it does a concert function, Greenwald said. The music is woven into the fabric of people's daily lives. There is some intentionality about participation. The festival began with performances by Joan Soriano from the Dominican Republic and Emmeline Michael from Haiti. Both artists are from the divided island of La Hispaniola, but despite growing up about 300 miles apart, roughly the same distance between Durham and Baltimore, their sounds could not be more different. Soriano is a bachata singer from the countryside, known for his steel string guitar work. Michael has been called the Queen of the Haitian Song, working across genres in her popular multi-decade career. Soriano sings in Spanish, Michael in Creole, and occasionally French and English. On Wednesday night comes Venezuelan group Bethara Machada y la Paranada El Clavo, a Malian group. This group will premiere on Thursday, and Honduran Garifuna artist Arellano will be on Friday. Each of these artists comes out of a long tradition of refuge and resistance within their countries. Machado and her band grew up in a jungle region in Venezuela, where escaped Africans settled hundreds of years ago. As Afro-Venezuelans who came from a community of landowners and a history of slave rebellions, their songs have a political bent. In Mali, religious extremists have seized parts of the country and outlawed music, but groups like Trio de Cali continue to play. Its members, all children of canonical West African musicians, are practical musical royalty in Mali. They represent the current generation of the Griots, a traveling group of musical storytellers who performed oral histories carried down across generations. Today, Trio de Cali continues to sing those histories, as well as make new ones, such as their Barbara version of Mahalia Jackson's God Shall Wipe All Tears Away. Aurelio Martinez, the Honduran musician better known as simply as Aurelio, will play Garifuna music on Friday evening. The week concludes with global icon Diego El Cigala, a Spanish artist who made his name in flamenco, then expanded into tonga and salsa. In 2014, he fled Spain to become a citizen of the Dominican Republic. His latest album was recorded in Spain, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Cuba, New York City, and Miami, taking up the salsa canon across the continents. Diego El Cigala really speaks to these roots of travel that music has taken. Anderson notes, the Black Atlantic Festival is not defined by a unidirectional flow of influence, but by a continuous exchange. I don't think it's all running through Africa, then going to Latin America, and then the Caribbean, Greenwald said. It's all going back and forth, wrapping around. Duke Performances has also partnered with the Forum for Scholars and Publics to host a series of conversations on Black Atlantic during the festival. They commence with a keynote conversation between Ned Sublett and Michael Veal, moderated by Dubois. Dubois and Sublett will also moderate a conversation between Soriano and Miquel on La Española de Morocco on Tuesday evening. The festivities throughout the week included Bacata Lessons, a demonstration on Batasiada at Cocoa Cinnamon, and a Parrande, a traveling steep performance similar to caroling. Given its many pieces and dynamics, the connections that form the foundation of Black Atlantic are difficult to define in any region way. Though this group of artists has a broad shared heritage as part of the African diaspora, their musical output spans several styles. While I think it may be impossible to find a single common thread that connects all these bands, I also deeply believe that there is some shared and ephemeral spark that lays at the heart of it all, Henderson said. These musical cultures all share a history of resilience and profound genius in the face of unimaginably difficult circumstances. But perhaps they are connected not just by a shared history, but also by their future-looking visions for freedom and musical invention. The Black Atlantic Festival doesn't seem to be trying to answer this question. Instead, it seems to be trying to ask it in inventive ways. We don't have any Cuban artists. We don't have any Brazilian artists. We don't have any South African artists. We don't have any American artists performing this year, Greenwald said. But this can be drawn in numerous different ways, and we hope that different kinds of resonances and answers will come out in this festival each year. And now from the stage section, renewable energy. The Bull City Black Theater Festival indicates that African-American artists will soar to greater heights as Durham Skyline does. Walking into Man Bite Dog Theater for the first weekend of the Bull City Black Theater Festival, which continues this weekend, was bittersweet. You could feel the decades of Durham history, all the plays and improv shows and artistic gatherings in the building. Man Bites is closing after this season, leaving a progressive artistic legacy behind. As I waited to be seated, Jameix Holloway Burrell, one of the festival's main organizers, approached each guest in the lobby with a heartfelt greeting before a Friday night staging of Dasan Abi's play, Definition of a Hero. Holloway Burrell embraced a few patrons while being timidly nudged by the front desk that it was 5 minutes until call time, and were the actors ready? They were ready. Holloway Burrell's Black Ops Theater Company had been creating spaces for African-American performances in the Triangle since 2015, and the Bull City Black Theater Festival shows she won't be letting up anytime soon. in a world that is telling more and more actors and hip art artists, for that matter, that Atlanta is the go-to hub if they want to succeed, Holloway Borrell and her amazing crew of directors, stage managers, volunteers, and of course actors showed that high-quality theater is thriving right here in the Bull City. One of my favorite aspects of the festival was the talkbacks, in which engaging conversations about featured plays were fostered between audience, cast, and crew. That isn't what I have normally experienced at Playmakers or DPAC. Often one pays for the art, absorbs the art, and then leaves, perhaps commenting with your friends later or tweeting about it to the world. I also saw a wide variety of reactions to the plays, with people laughing, gasping, and snapping at very different points. But the discussions brought everyone, audience, actors, writers, and the stage crew, to the same level. In each presentation, the audience not only experienced an amazing work of art, but also left with a fuller interpretation from the black hands that built it. Holly Burrell opened the space with a prayer-like gesture, giving thanks to those within the community that gave the ability to have its own theater festival, saying to Black Poetry Theater founders Church de Poet and Dasanayu that her work was built on their backs. She also was surprised and pleased on Saturday to see a mentor of hers from North Carolina Central University Theater Department, Chair Stephanie Asabi M. Howard. I learned how many of the heroes that reside within our community go unsung. But the Bull City Black Theater Ensemble shows that Durham is more than ready for the opportunity for the biggest stage. In addition to more amazing work to digest this weekend, there will be a variety of chances to get involved and learn. Black Op aims to educate and inform our community through workshops for playwrights. This weekend also features one discussion with Playmakers Catherine Hunter Williams and another with Manot Noel Marshall on a recent impactful show, By My Soul and Call It Art. There's a lot one offer for anyone who wants to write the next James Baldwin play, but not that anyone will ever equal James Baldwin. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Reedy Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So, until next week, bye, good night, and good morning.